Welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Vajra Watson. Dr. Watson is the Director of Research and Policy for Equity at the University of California, Davies. She is also the founder and director of Sacramento Area Youth Speaks, SAYS. SAYS is a writing program aimed at students, poet mentor educators, and teachers, which enables participants to critically reflect upon and read the world around them. Dr. Watson has recently authored Learning to Liberate, Community-Based Solutions to the Crisis in Education. I have asked her to discuss this inspiring book with me today. I spoke with Dr. Watson over the telephone from her office at UC Davies.
Hello, Vajra, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. A guiding principle that repeats itself throughout Learning to Liberate is the principle of love. How is love relevant to working with young people?
You know, I think that transformative work demands that all of who we are is involved. And as one of the participants in the study said, you know, so many of us burn out because we were never burned on in the first place. And I think part of how we sustain this work is that it's reciprocal. And it's just not going in one direction. So that comes with the respect we give young people as well as the love. When I really kind of reflected on how I was going to take the work of the community-based educators and integrate it into my own life, into my own work with youth, you know, I could not become, you know, for instance, Dorica, Rudy, Victor, or Jack, who I feature in Learning to Liberate. I had to be, you know, Vajra, what are Vajra's best practices? And so love was one that I felt as a teacher I really exemplified because I would always go above and beyond with my students. And yet the love I witnessed in these community-based spaces was kind of distinct and different in certain ways. Some of the kind of tough love approach, some of the high expectations that at times push young people away, and yet hold them to this higher standard at the same time. And so I felt and started to reflect on just the way that my love actually might have debilitated students in some respects and how love, like in any relationships, is so multifaceted, and to be able to even critique something as simple as love in the way that we engage young people.
The idea of paralysis with love, Bell Hooks talks about love as a verb, as an action. And
that's right.
How has the love paralyzed you in times? And then more importantly, how have you moved through that paralysis to find the action again in love?
Well, I would just say that when I was a teacher and I, for instance, let's say I would do a home visit and I would see some of the things that my students were living through, it would be hard for me to say, write that 15-page research paper and, you know, I'm going to grade you the same way I'm grading everybody else and you need to pass this test and these, you know, state standards. So for me, I felt like kind of implicitly I started lowering some of my standards in terms of what I was expecting of young people. So even though I love them, it was much, I think, when I think about their overall development, now I've come to a place after kind of witnessing the ways that the community-based educators help young people empower themselves is that I'm going to hold you to these high standards. I'm going to expect and help you do this paper because I love you, because it is what I would want for my own children, and I wouldn't want your circumstance to determine your destiny. And I think that that was a recurring lesson for me. So in the spirit of love being an action, love being a verb, you know, same with education. Education is not a noun. Education is a verb. So it is something that we do. It is alive. It is a process. And it is kind of in that spirit that I think we can see some of the deepest and most profound changes. So when you talk about a young person going from juvenile hall to college, we can all say, yeah, that's a great idea. But how do we get there? How do we actually make that happen? And I think that's where people's kind of pedagogies and philosophies and daily practices differ. And for these community-based educators in Learning to Liberate, love was foremost in that transformative practice.
But let's talk about those community educators. You do profiles of four different people. Can you introduce us to each of these four people?
Absolutely. So I did my doctoral work on the East Coast, but I was really interested in coming home. I'm born and raised in the Bay Area, so I came back to the Bay Area, and I spent a year talking to young people and educators and faculty and youth development workers, and I said, who is the best of the best in being able to reach and teach young people that are most, quote-unquote, high risk? And I came up with a list of about 12 people that I continued to hear about, and then I went and I visited them really informally and got to talk to the young people about why they think their kind of community-based educator is the best of the best. And I also looked at who is truly working with high-risk youth, kind of the rough, tough, and misled youth and able to make these changes. So the first person I highlight is Dorica Blackman, who at the time was the Executive Director of Leadership Excellence, which is an Afrocentric education and youth leadership program in Oakland, and they focus primarily in West Oakland. The second person is Rudy Corpus, who is the founder and executive director of United Players, which is a gang prevention youth leadership family throughout San Francisco. Victor Damian, the third person I feature and do a portrait on, he started this youth task force, which to be on the task force, it's associated with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Young people need to be in juvenile justice, substance abuse, foster care, and special education. So even to be an advocate, they have to really meet those, requirements in order to advocate for systems change. And the final person is the co-founder of the Omega Boys Club in San Francisco, which is quite famous, and the person, Jack Jacquois, he teaches in Juvenile Hall as well as in San Quentin and other facilities across California.
When I was reading the profiles, I was so struck. I was so motivated. I kept telling people about this book that I was reading and how inspiring I found it. I also want to commend you for turning a doctoral research project into such a compelling read. That's quite a remarkable. So you talked to the young people they worked with. You met with them. How did you decide that these were the people that you wanted to focus on?
I mean, really it came down to, how I went from like a list of 12 to a list of 4. The main two was what young people were saying. So they would talk about kind of their own, especially in the informal stages, when they were just giving me kind of gut-wrenching testimonies about how this person had changed them or had changed a family member, and what their kind of presence was at the school, in the community, in the neighborhood, really trying to get a feel for those assets, because I wanted somebody that was real. So one of the things, like when I would go to Hunter's Point, I would ask kids on 3rd Street, which is like a main kind of area at the time, that'd be like, if someone gets shot, who is here? Who is here? Who is helping put groceries in the fridge? Who is holding your grandma's hand? Who is there? Because the police aren't necessarily there as healers. The teachers aren't necessarily put to be healers. So is there somebody? Is it a reverend? Is it a, social worker? Is it a auntie? Like, who is it? And so I really wanted these type of folks that are, like, in the trenches, so to speak, dealing with this stuff day in and day out. So that was such a huge piece for me. And then the other one was just that the actual students that they worked with were, not simply, middle-class kids of color who people like to call at risk, but kids that were really caught in the streets and were on a trajectory to either be incarcerated for the rest of their lives or be 6 feet under in a grave. And if they could make kind of so-called miraculous changes with that demographic, those lessons to me could permeate all work we do with young people, whether we're working with privileged young people, whether we're working with, you know, middle-of-the-road kids, but being able to have that level of impact, I felt like the lessons would be pivotal to our work, our larger work in education and youth engagement.
You come up with quite a compelling list of lessons that you learned, and you identified 10 particular values that each of the four educators share. I don't want to go into all 10 of these. There are several that really jumped out at me, and you spoke a bit about this earlier, with this being a calling. This is a way of life, not just a job. I was struck by how available the educators were, all hours, all days. How does that level of presence support young people?
Well, I think it's a much more kind of community family lens. And so for the community-based educators, they don't see a distinction between their own children or their own family responsibilities and that of their program. It's all one aspect. And so, you know, Rudy might bring his two-year-old to a meeting with the mayor, and he doesn't blink twice about it. And even, you know, for me with the SES program I now direct, I could be a mom that stresses because I don't have a babysitter at night because I have to go run poetry slams and I'm, you know, having to do kind of all this kind of support or a young person needs a ride. And I could feel really fractured, or I could have my kids be integrated into the space to the point where they're like, oh, we need to go pick up our cousin Chabrielle, who's like a young person that I work with, and we need to give her a ride to her, you know, to school because, you know, she, you know what I mean? So I think that there's a way that it can be more integrated so that people don't feel so fractured in the work. And in terms of the impact that it has on young people, it then feels genuine. It then feels like you're not doing this because you're getting a paycheck. You're not doing this because it's a job. You know, if there was no job and there was no paycheck, I could still call you, and I would still be able to ask for your advice or ask for something if I'm in need. So I think that it's not to say that people don't need breaks or people don't need space from the work, because I think we all have to find ways to revivify ourselves and not get to places where it becomes a burden. But young people, anywhere I've gone in the world, young people see through the facade, and if it's genuine, they return it tenfold.
There seems to be increasing dialogue in working with young people around what are boundaries right now. What are appropriate boundaries? What are enmeshed boundaries and rigid boundaries? And I think the power of the educators that you profile is their effectiveness. And time again, I've talked to people, young people. You know, when I talk about what do you like about this worker, what makes this person great, they talk about someone who goes above and beyond, someone who's there, who, to use your phrase, burns on and burns on.
Yeah. And it can be simple, you know, little things too, like, you know, I mean, I go into schools and kids will say, you know, the teachers never look me in the eye, or the teachers are afraid of me, or, you know what I mean? Sometimes it doesn't even have to be as extreme as, you know, giving so much. Sometimes it's just small steps, you know, looking a young person in the eye and being like, I know your name. I recognize you as a human being. And I was working in one middle school, you know, because there's all this stuff around bullying and this and that, and when I pulled out the kids that were on kind of on-campus suspension, and I said, well, what's going on here, and what's bullying? And they're like, we are being bullied every day. And I'm like, great, okay, I want to let's break it down. I want to get to the bottom of this. I'm like, who is bullying you? And they said, our teachers. You know, I don't think that every educator, every kind of youth-serving practitioner is going to, you know, envelop these 10 principles and say, you know, today I give my life to this work. But our children are so at risk that we have to take risks to do our work differently and more creatively, because it truly is an issue of life and death for so many of them. And so if it makes a difference between life and death, you looking someone in the eye, smiling and saying, welcome, thank you for coming, gosh, let's just start there. You know, sometimes it takes baby steps to make a movement.
Yes, it really is a baby step to look somebody in the eye, and how profound it is. I mean, you talk about listening, ear hustling, which is a phrase that I quite liked, and how important that is to work with young people. You also discuss the nature of the reciprocal relationship of learning, right? That learning is not, you know, as Pereira talked about, the banking, right? Mm-hmm. Filling up the empty head, that we as educators, youth workers, learn as well. How do we stay open to that learning process?
Well, you know, I was struck recently by Father Boyle, who does work in L.A., and he was giving a speech. He's worked with L.A., primarily Chicano gang members for the past, you know, few decades, and he was talking about he entered the work really believing like he was the caregiver and then they were the client, right? So that there was somebody that he had an answer, kind of a therapeutic answer, and then the person on the other end had a problem or a wound to be solved. And I think that that's a banking system in kind of human relations, whether we think of education or, you know, whether we think of, you know, kind of social work or what have you, right? So this banking concept of I have something that you need and I have a tool that you need. And he said that over the decades, time and time again, you know, he was tired one night, you know, burnt out. He had been, you know, coming from speaking engagement, and he was trying to raise money for the program, all this stuff. And this noted heroin addict came into his office who he couldn't stand. She was always kind of in front of the center harassing people, always coming around. And he's like, gosh, you know, it's 10 at night. I don't want to deal with her, but whatever. This is my duty. So he lets her in, and he starts to, you know, talk with her. And by the end of the talk, he realized how much she had healed him. And that this process of human archaeology, when we delve into the issues of soul, of kind of wretched glory, because that's what it takes to have this level of, you know, I'm gonna put down a gun and I'm gonna pick up, you know, my own life, or I'm going to put down this heroin needle and I'm going to, you know, this level of change. And he said that he realized that this notion of client and service provider is like a colonial mentality. We are all in service to one another. And so in terms of the, and I love the way he explained it, because it was what I was trying to get to and trying to explain in terms of what I experienced, but I don't think I even did it justice. Because the reciprocity means that, you know, we are both givers and receivers in the lesson, whatever that lesson might be. And I think that everyone then grows, everyone changes, and everyone develops. And so it's not so much about I'm coming to save you, or I have this kind of missionary complex and I have things that you need so you can empower yourself. No, I've had many a young people check me to my core and have me realize that I might be really book smart, but, you know, have a lot to learn, or vice versa. It's always a spectrum of development, and I get the answers I can give, but I also receive the answers that they have to teach me. Does that make sense?
It makes great sense, and it sounds like you're open to receiving those answers.
Hmm.
And the idea, once again, of listening to be present. So crucial in our work. Social justice is huge in this book, and you write about sharing knowledge and tools with the explicit intent of dismantling oppressive systems. There are a lot of people who would argue that this overt political stance might disengage some young people, that it might alienate people who are not interested in changing oppressive structures. They just want to get a job.
Right.
How do we?
And I want them to have a job too.
Good.
I don't want anyone going hungry. I mean, one of the things that we always say is like, gosh, you know, we have students in this work or over the years that can, like, you know, recite Marcus Garvey's and the Black Panther Party 10-point program, and they're living out their car. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there has to be a balance between people's material conditions improving as well as their consciousness, and that those things are not mutually exclusive but actually mutually beneficial. So in terms of the social justice stance with the book, I mean, on one hand, I think that we have a lot of students, especially when we think of, like, in California, we have one dropout for every three high school graduates. So we have a huge dropout crisis in the state. And some of the reasons that the kids drop out, for many reasons, but some of them just say, like, it's bull. There's a farce, right? And I find more reality and, you know, in the streets or in this fast money or this, that, and the other. So what we have is a generation of rebels. But they're rebels without a cause. Like, when I think of, like, you know, the street thug who's, you know, just like, F everybody, you know, excuse my language, but just has that mentality. Well, what would it happen if those same young people who Rudy said, like, walk through Baghdad barefoot, you know, the young people who have, you know, were born on crack and are snorting cocaine at 14 and, you know, it's nothing to have an AK. You know what I mean? Like, it's nothing to have. You want a reputation of a killer, and you want a reputation of being in and out of prison. But if those same young people that have so much anger for the system and anger was to actually, you know, turn that into being rebels with a cause. So most revolutions in the world have been started by young people. When you think about the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, when you think about, you know, even civil rights here in the United States, the movement in Chiapas, Mexico, I mean, there's so many international examples of youth really being able to see the world anew. And I would say that that was what has drawn me to the age group so much, because you can go pretty much to any school, you know, maybe in the world. I mean, I can't speak to Canada because I don't know it as well, and say, if you could do something differently, what would you do? And I find that the answers are really piercing. And that's not to say, oh, every young person needs to be an anarchist, because I don't even, you know, that's not even kind of my kind of theoretical or kind of practical advice. But what I say is that see the world anew, and let us give you the tools so that you can change and live to the best of your ability. I also think it's very important for young people, teachers and the like, for all of us to understand the systems of oppression that mitigate our destiny, so that the, you know, too often the disenfranchised grow up to be disenfranchised, and there's all these systems in place that help that happen. So having people have a much more critical understanding of the infrastructure and how to navigate that. So people advocate ways to navigate that. They say teach young people to have cultural capital or social capital, human capital, resistance capital. I mean, my work really focuses on, you know, I would say primarily the place of agency and how all those things come together with tools, you know, of love, of liberation, of listening, kind of leadership and learning, so that whatever that agency happens to be, you know, institutional change begins with personal transformation. And I don't know what systems will be broken down or what new ones will be, you know, rise out of it, but I do think it needs to genuinely be a movement that is kind of led by the masses, by the quote-unquote 99%, as folks today would say.
Yes, the young people who are capable and brilliant, and as you, I think, accurately say, are misled. And
yeah.
giving them the tools to, you know, the compass, if you will, to to look at the direction that they want to go in. I want to move towards wrapping up. One of the pieces you write right at the end is that the youth of today are ready for empowerment, but are we? What do you see as the resistance, particularly from youth workers and educators? How do we block young people's empowerment and agency?
Well, I'll give you an example. You know, I do this spoken word program in schools, and we're focused in all these English language arts classes, and so we're getting students to write. And when we first came in and we're doing these writing workshops, you know, a lot of people were like, wow, we didn't know our students could write that much. And for a few teachers, it's now become they feel threatened by the pad and the pencil. And they're like, you know, this is like stirring up, you know, I don't know. I don't know if we should do writing anymore. And I was so taken back by that because I had never even fathomed someone saying that. And I think that sometimes people get really caught in the power dynamics and like who should have power and who doesn't have power and who's the authoritarian and who's not the authoritarian. We kind of get caught in these modes of hierarchy that really disempower everyone at the table. So I think part of the way that adults can the way that we kind of are afraid of young people's empowerment or, you know, are unsure of what it will become has to do with our own issues. When I was teaching, a vice principal came up to me and said, we need to know what side are you on. Are you on their side or are you on our side? And the kind of motif was that I was really a student-driven teacher. I was really a student-centered teacher, and I didn't see the need to, you know, to constantly kind of put my students in their place in the sense of drawing that level of line. And the worst part, I guess, for me professionally is that when I would be in faculty meetings or staff development trainings, I would advocate for students. I would advocate for student-led, student-centered spaces, and I was seen as a traitor. And I was like, what do you mean, what side am I on? Are we in a war? Did someone not announce it? It's like youth versus adults, teachers and administrators versus kids. I just think that those are false power dynamics that actually fuels a bureaucracy that is ineffective where everyone is sick. You know, kind of institutional trauma. Everyone gets sickened by that. You know, we actually could have the same systems in place, but have them joyful. Same hierarchy. It could be authoritarian. It could be experts. It could be all these things, but come from a place of joy, of love, of respect, of community, comunidad, so that it doesn't break us down as individuals or as a collective, but genuinely builds up our humanity.
Joy, love, respect, community. Vajra Watson. I think that's a beautiful, beautiful place to end. Thank you very, very much for joining
thank
us.
You.
And thank you so much for writing this book. I encourage many, many, many people to read it. I think it's an important and contribution to the field, as well as a super engaging read. So thank you very much.
Yes, you too. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.